Good morning, everybody. I just want to welcome y'all this morning. I'm so glad everybody could get out and nobody has really, really sick kids this week. Dara, however, had one with a fever all night. But she is here with a smile on her face and ready to share with y'all. She's probably not the best rested she's been in her life. But anyway, I met Dara 4 years ago. And she just had two little ones then, and now she's got three. Sadie is her oldest, Cal is the boy in the middle, and Bridget is her sweet little baby girl who was sick last night. As I've watched Dara parent her kids over the years, I've known her, I've been so impressed with how very calm she is when she parents them and how very calm they are. And just even watching her when she has to call to one of them who's down the hall, she uses her normal voice. But they are so in tune to her voice, they stop and come back. And it amazes me because with mine, I had to keep saying their name and get a little louder and get a little louder. So it's always really impressed me watching her parent her children when they do get emotional. So we have the pleasure of her coming this morning just to share healthy emotions in kids, helping you learn how to parent your kids to healthy emotions. And if anybody, like I grew up in a home where I didn't know what that looked like just because there was a lot of anger in my house. So I never knew what, you know, is this normal for me to be upset about this? I don't know. So please listen to her this morning, and if you grew up in a home like that as well, and learn how to parent your kids to healthy emotions.
Say that, Justine. Justine's excited. That is a feeling word. Well, thanks for being here. This stool feels awkwardly tall, but that's okay. I'm going to bring this up. So I have a little picture for your enjoyment. That is our crew. I finally, like 7 months into having a third child, have like two pictures with all five of us. Steve is my husband, Sadie is six, Cal just turned four, and Bridget is 7 months, like she just said, but you'll hear me talk about them a lot today, so it might help to hear it again. I have lived in Atlanta 10, 11 years now since coming to college at Georgia Tech. I became a Christian at Georgia Tech through campus outreach, and that is how I met Steve. He also became a believer through campus outreach at UGA and went to work for campus outreach right out of college and still does work on the campuses in the Atlanta area under Perimeter. So we have the privilege of doing that. I am primarily at home with the kids, but the gift of being in ministry is that I get to do whatever I want whenever I can with the ministry, and they're happy to have me, which is great. So I get plenty of opportunities to connect with staff women and women on the campus. And one of the things I've become particularly passionate about is connecting with people in their stories and their circumstances and the feelings that come out of those stories and circumstances, mainly because I've realized that, like me, most people haven't been given the value for feelings or the understanding for their feelings that they really need to even know what to do with them. And so it's really easy to step in there as somebody who's had even the littlest bit of development and that stuff to be helpful. And that has been really gratifying. All that to say, I have no degree in this. I am not a counselor. I am not seminary trained. This is just going to be a lot of my story and my experiences and things to hopefully encourage you and help you, but none of this is a should or a this is right. It's just my experience. And we're going to do some time, too, for you to connect with the stuff that we're talking about on your own and with somebody at your table. We're going to do partners today instead of whole table talk, just so even the best listeners among us still get the chance to engage with the material. So when it comes time for that, just pair with one person. And if you have an odd number of people at your table, do a threesome. But let's not get any bigger than that. So let me start with my story just to give you some understanding of where I'm coming from. These are my parents, my mom and dad. They provided a great home. We lived in Dalton, Georgia, which is a pretty small city. It was about 30,000 when I was there. I think it's a little bigger now, but they were not believers that I know of. We were nominally involved in a Methodist church there. We would go on holidays. But they were very faithful to each other and to us, and we had a really happy home. When I was in high school, however, my mom was put in the hospital with a really severe seizure. She had to be sedated, strapped to the bed. I'll never get that vision out of my mind, that picture of her writhing in the bed. Ultimately, they found a tumor that was so far gone. It was stage 4, and she was given at most 3 months to live. The surgeon said, there's nothing I can do. So she went in on to some experimental treatments, and I was 16, and my brother was in college, and I was home just with my mom and dad. And my dad was great, but he was very aloof, and I don't think really knew how to be a dad to a daughter. He always coached my brother's teams, and he knew how to do that stuff, but we didn't have much of a relationship. So the idea of being without my mom was really terrible. And I didn't know what to do with that. I had all of these emotions, and I didn't have any sense of how to engage them or let them come. They only seemed like an inconvenience. So I learned the best thing I could do was just to avoid them at all costs, and then they would bubble up when I couldn't, if somebody looked at me sideways, you know, or like asked the wrong question and suddenly I was a basket case. But I tried to keep functioning, and then a year later, my dad tells us that he's been having back pain. He went in to have it looked at, and he also has cancer. It has spread to his bones, and he won't live. So at this point, my mom was utterly dependent on him. She lost all her short-term memory with her brain cancer and her balance. So she couldn't function by herself, and now my dad also had a terminal diagnosis. And as you can imagine, I just kind of became a shell of a person. I was just trying to get through high school, get to college, with them very much otherwise occupied, and nobody else really in my life trying to help, which is kind of crazy in retrospect. I never knew any people who went to counselors. Apparently that wasn't a thing in Dalton at that time. Nobody ever offered it anyway, and people brought a lot of food, which was great, and occasionally came over to do our laundry so that I didn't have to do it, but that was about it. So I was kind of left to figure it out for myself. And thankfully, at Georgia Tech, God intervened. In some really supernatural ways. There were some women who had unusually high levels of both spiritual maturity and emotional maturity for 18-year-olds, and then a wife of a campus outreach staff person who also connected with me. And what they began to help me see was that basically what my relationship to my emotions had become was finding the things that would keep me from feeling them and throwing myself completely into those things. So food was a great one for me. Alcohol became a great one once we were in college and that was readily available. And boys. I was completely unhappy, other just disregard my grief over my parents, but life was just kind of miserable. But that was all I knew to do, and it was really destructive. So what I began to see is they introduced me to God's word and how to read his word and relate to him through his word. And as they showed me what a friend can be in God's design, asking good questions and continuing to show up, even though I wasn't the fun person. I think that was one of the big things I had begun to believe about myself, was that if I let anybody see what was really going on in my heart, nobody would want to be my friend, because that's no fun. Who at 18 wants to be friends with somebody who's just sad all the time? Nobody. So I didn't feel safe in any of my relationships until these girls came along and they showed me that they had a value for me outside of just what was fun about me. And so this has become something that is really important to me, because I've found that, and you all have a handout. This is written word for word at the top of your handout, so y'all can follow along with me. And this is kind of my thesis statement, if you will. Feelings are important because we were made to glorify God by bearing the image of God. He designed us with desire, motivation, and will to create, to bring order, to love and be loved, to enjoy, to have purpose and significance, to do a good job, to see justice done, to protect and provide, because he himself has all of these desires. Feelings arise when these desires are either fulfilled or denied. We have positive feelings when a God-displaying desire is fulfilled, and negative feelings when a God-displaying desire is denied. When we experience these feelings, we experience God, and we grow in our relationship with him, and we display God to those around us. So our emotions, positive and negative, grow and develop our relationship with God and our relationship with others. And what that means is that even sitting in utter despair or seething in anger can actually be a good thing. For example, you bring a foster child into your home who has broken bones, and you are angry. You have no compassion for that home that child has come out of. You're just angry. And what you're experiencing in that moment is your God, who loves that child and wants good for that child and wants justice and the right thing to be done and for them to have a home where they're loved, and they're not. That desire has been denied in their experience, and that produces anger, and it angers God too. So you're experiencing your father in that emotion. And when somebody dies that you love and you're just so sad, you're in despair, you're experiencing your God, who designed us for eternal life and relationship with each other, and is grieved by the separation that's caused by death. And I included a verse here that I think conveys this really well. It's in 2 Corinthians 1, 3-5, and says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For as we share abundantly in Christ's sufferings, So through Christ, we share abundantly in comfort too. And this is all throughout Scripture. This walk through a broken world and all the pain that comes with it, and the deep experience of the joy of God in his mercy and kindness and comfort. But I don't want you to just take my word for it. I want y'all to experience this. So I included some passages from the Psalms, which has been a place that I've spent a lot of time, thanks to somebody who showed me how she prays the Psalms. It's become a big part of my walk with God, and I think has really fueled my connection with my emotions and with God in my emotions. So we're going to take some time for you to look at those Psalms that are included on your page just by yourself, and notice all the feelings, and really we'll give like a good 10 minutes to this so you can really go slow and think about the implications of how David is relating to God. So go ahead and do that. All right, y'all, anybody tell me what you notice in Psalm 13, and don't be afraid to state the obvious if you feel like that's what you're doing. So what are the Psalms? What's he doing here? Yeah, he's talking to God. He's not just feeling all these things. He's talking to God about these things. And telling God really directly the worst of it. The stuff that would feel shameful in the culturally Christian way of thinking, like what Kelsey said, being totally preoccupied with yourself. Doubt, what Jasmine said, that it's easy to feel like that's not okay, but here it is. In the Bible, as a way of talking to your God. Yep. And I would say even the act of saying these things to God shows his faith, right? He has this, and I think honors God. He's operating out of his knowledge that my God hears me, and he's safe for me to say all these things to. And then what about Psalm 34, 1 through 8? What do you see there? Yeah, the culture has affected even our Christian spaces of being with this pressure of only having positive feelings. But what do you see in Psalm 34? I mean, this to me, it's the height of worship and praise. I mean, his heart sounds elated as he rejoices and exults in who his God is. Like, can even think and just for a second reflect on your walk with God and try and remember a season when you would have penned or prayed something like Psalm 34. And think back on that. Yeah, there are places in Scripture where David looks like straight foolish because he's like dancing around like a maniac, right? Like, like, let's rein that in. We're not all in that place. Yeah, he's finding God in every experience that he has. So true. And the word, I like that you use the word intense because that was my takeaway too. I said the more time you spend in the Psalms, you'll notice his expression of grief, anger, and confusion are so intense. And also, his worship is so rich and robust and joyous. And I think you can't have one without the other. So, that being said, if you're like me, that is not the narrative that you grew up hearing or are currently hearing about negative emotion in our culture. What I hear constantly and what I heard a lot growing up is that it's better to focus on the positive feelings, that is where a good experience is in life. It's the power of positive thinking. It's no bad vibes is like, you know, what everybody's saying right now. People are like putting it on posters on their wall. And I think it, there's a lot there that we could talk about and get into. But what I want us to focus on is our experience in a closer way of our families of origin, our parents, even grandparents, whoever you were close to, peers, and authority figures. And as a means of kicking us off there, I have some personal stories. And what you need to know for these stories to make sense. Okay. Just making sure I didn't miss something. I don't do this a lot. I don't know if you could tell. So I was made fun of a lot as a kid. I was really overweight, and my mom had like stick, straight, shiny, beautiful hair, and so she did to my hair what she would do to her own, which was to brush it. So I lived my whole life until I was like 13 thinking I had like the worst hair in the world, and I had this huge gap between my two front teeth, and I used to get mocked mercilessly for all of the above. There was like the most mundane nicknames, including like Miss Piggy, to like the most clever, which was Dairy Queen, because my name is Dara. It was a really big part of my youth. And my mom was a really, really compassionate person. She had a lot of feelings herself. So she was sympathetic. She didn't shame me for my feelings or make me feel wrong for having hurt feelings. But her approach was to try and fix them. She would call the mom of whoever the child was, who was the pain of the week. And, you know, so to try and, like, fix it, make sure it didn't happen again. And then she would treat the sadness, try to remove me from my hurt and my sadness with usually ice cream. And she would be with me in it. And, you know, in many ways, it was sweet. But the communication from that was there's nothing good to be had in your sadness. So we're just going to try and get out of it. We're not going to talk about why that made you sad, or I'm going to be angry at that kid, and I'm going to call his mom, and then we're going to fix it with ice cream. A lot of Baskin-Robbins mint chocolate chip happened in our house. That was the flavor of choice. So that was my mom, and then my peers taught me this little jingle you may have heard before, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And they were like, you gotta be tough. Like, if it doesn't hurt you, they'll stop doing it because their satisfaction is from the fact that you're getting upset. You have to stop showing them that you're getting upset. So that was like, became a little mantra. And then I had an experience in high school that's like, there are a lot of probably things I could look back on with authority figures in my life, but this one I will never forget. It was very shaping. I was probably, I guess, like 14. I think it was my freshman year. And my teacher was, like, fed up with us. She was like, we're just quiet, busy work. No talking. Absolutely no talking. Well, I'm, like, a talker, and I just, you know, forget sometimes. I have very little control over how much I talk. And I especially did at 14 have very little control. So at some point under my breath, I think I said something like, oh, it's Friday. And she, like, bam, like, okay, everybody, because your friend Dara decided she was going to talk, I'm assigning this and this and this and this and the list. Everybody has all of this as homework because of Dara. So now, as an adult, I think I can look back and rationally say that is like a really good reason for a 14-year-old girl to get upset. I mean, as if it's not hard enough to deal with the pressures of your peers, and it's like all you can think about is to please your parents and please your friends. And it was like, I just ruined their lives. So I cry. I go to the bathroom. I cry some more. And later, a friend of mine overheard that teacher telling another teacher that I must be emotionally unstable. And of course she came and told me, because that's what good friends do, right? Like, let me, this person was ragging on you, I'm gonna tell you what she said. And that, I believed it, instantly I believed it. Like, that would explain why I cry a lot. I must be emotionally unstable. There is something wrong with me. And then my dad, he took the approach of protecting everyone from even the potential of negative emotions, especially us kids. He communicated that negative feelings are bad and something to be protected from, and children especially should not be exposed to negative feelings. So that manifested a lot with his disease. I would regularly find things out, and it was like, Dad, why didn't you tell me? And he's like, well, I didn't want to bring you into that. Like, you didn't need to know that. That would have just, like, ruined your week. And it happened all the time. And the pinnacle of this was that he didn't want my mom to know that he had cancer, because he didn't think she could handle it. So he told us, because we had to know. There was no missing it. But he told us not to tell my mom. So for 4 years, we lived with this knowledge, and we couldn't tell her or let her know. And he also kept it a secret from most of our hometown, so that he didn't want to lose his business. We were told we couldn't even talk to people about it. And he just expected that should be okay, because that had been his approach his whole life. When something bad happens, you just lock it up and you don't let it out on anybody else, because that's not their problem. So what I want us to do now is I want you guys to take a minute and think about what your experience is. First, of your family. Take a couple of minutes. What did they believe and communicate about feelings and emotion? Write down any key expressions you heard or experiences you had of them. Okay, I'm going to bring us back together. I would love for you guys to keep talking about this stuff offline with each other, but for the sake of time, can you not hear me? Oh, hey, sorry. I thought I was a little louder than I actually am. I'm going to talk a little louder. I'm going to bring us back together. I wish we could spend all day doing that. But yeah, I would encourage you, keep talking about this stuff in other opportunities. But I know that we want to move on to hearing about our kids, so I'm going to keep us moving. So how my story continues, as you can see from the picture, my parents did not die as quickly as they were supposed to. I didn't get married at 17, though I was close to 17. I was only 22, so. It was always fraught with trouble, but we did get more time with them than we originally thought, and I'm very thankful for that. My dad died 6 years after his diagnosis, and my mom died 12 years after her diagnosis, which was just 2 years ago, when I was 28 and my oldest was almost 4. So this is where it gets into my parenting, because I couldn't hide from her. My grief was overwhelming, even though I had had 12 years of knowing it was coming. I didn't expect the loss of somebody who was so sick to still be so hard. And I did a lot of crying, and she at that time was home with me all the time, so there was no hiding it. And I was amazed, y'all, by her. She would ask me, you know, why I was crying. And I could have pushed her off. I could have tried to keep it to myself like my dad would have done, in the interest of sparing her. But instead, I just decided to be honest. And so I told her, and she knew, my mom, like it wasn't, we had to tell her that my mom died. Like, she had spent a lot of time with her. So we had to tell her that this thing had happened. And now I'm so glad, because there are so many opportunities in life for me to keep stuff from my kids, but I choose not to anymore, because I've seen how they handled it with my mom, and it was amazing for us to engage in that together. So I told her, I'm sad. I miss Dee Dee. I am sad because she died, and I can't talk to her anymore, and I can't hug her, and I don't get to see her anymore, and I'm sad. And she would, from that point on, then she internalized it, and it was like, I got this. And every time I would cry, she would ask, Mom, are you sad because Dee Dee died? Because you miss Dee Dee, is what she would usually ask. And I would say, yeah. And she would go to the bathroom. And because my relationship with tissue boxes is that they're super helpful when you need them, but they cost extra money in your grocery budget, and most of the time they take up space on your counter and collect dust and are super gross. So we usually blow our nose with toilet paper in my house. So she would go to the bathroom, and she would meticulously, in good firstborn fashion, tear off one square of toilet paper, and she would bring it to me. And she would sit with me, and she... And it was just the sweetest thing. And I was amazed at her capacity for understanding and connecting in my emotions at 4. So I wanted to build out her understanding of other emotions too, so that she could understand me and that she could understand herself when her emotions come, and ultimately her God. And it's been such a gift to see that unfold in their lives. Guiding our children to a whole and true understanding of God, the world, and themselves will set them up for health. And that gets us to the reverse side of your page. So a whole and true understanding of God, the world, and themselves will set them up for health. And in these early years, you can lay a foundation for that health with how they see you handle your emotions and how you treat them and their emotions. Because it can feel really overwhelming to think about talking about theology with your little kid. Like, first, you don't really know how to say it in a way that they'll understand. And second, you're not even always really sure the right answers. And man, do they have questions when you start talking about it. And so it can feel like, gosh, can I really tell them all the right things? And I think what I've found is that it's not always what you say so much as it is how they see you handle your emotions and how you treat them and their emotions is what is laying the foundations for this worldview of what's the place for negative emotion in our walk with God and in our experience in our relationships. Now, we've just spent a little bit of time on that part of how you handle your own emotions, and that should be its own like week-long seminar and experience, and we can't, and we're not today, But I would encourage you to go back to that. If it's not something that you have spent much time thinking about before, God's view of emotions, what your view your whole life has been of emotion, then I would just say go back to it and do some more thinking on how you relate to God and your emotions and to your husbands and your families and your kids and your emotions, because that really matters. It's really important. But now we're going to transition to talking about how we treat our kids and their emotions. So the first thing I have here, and it's funny, I wanted this for there to be some kind of like concise system, but really they're just like kept being things that were like, well, you got to think about this, and you got to think about this, and you got to think about this. So there's some structure here, but for those of you who like neat outlines, this doesn't really fit the bill. First is just to validate their feelings when they have them, not to shame, correct, or discipline an authentic emotion. Gail has a lot of good examples for you if you ever want to hear about somebody who got shamed or corrected or disciplined for her feelings as a child. She would be a great person to talk with if that was your experience. And you might ask, well, what is an authentic emotion? And I think we just go back to what we said at the beginning, that very first paragraph on your page. Authentic emotion displays the heart of God. So, for example, you fall down and you're hurt and you're sad, you cry. That is an authentic emotion, because pain grieves the heart of our God. So there are lots of things in Kid World that, in fact, I would say most of their emotions are authentic emotions, and they display the heart of God. So what you want to do in that moment is just take the time to validate that and say, like, yeah. I mean, most of the time, that's all I'm doing is like, I'm like, yes, I know. Yes, I say I know all day long. I know. Yes. We'll get into the nitty gritty, but I will say this does start earlier than you would ever imagine, because, as you know, their verbal is developing long before they can talk. So what they hear from you and see in you is really important. And it helps give you time to practice. Like, I screwed up a lot of theological explanations to my kids when they were like 8, you know, like maybe 2. And it's like, that's great. They don't remember that. So when they're 6 and I have to be a little better and get this right, like I've practiced 35 times. So yeah, starting really early, I think is great. So yeah, I understand. That makes sense. Yeah, I know. Like that's all it is. That number one, that's all it is just in that moment. And that what I would call shaming is something like, what is wrong with you? Is a, like, you just need to throw that question out of your vocabulary. And it's, y'all, it's welled up in me before, and I'm like, I don't even know where that comes from, but that is destructive. Like, I have got to be careful and stop myself when I try to ask them a question like, what, why, what is wrong with you? Because they don't know the answer to that question, and you're the one who needs to help them understand. So asking questions like that, never helpful. Usually just results in them feeling like, what's wrong with me? Correcting would be like, it's as simple as saying, you're okay. And that, y'all, again, all day long, what is that like come out of me? I think because I just probably heard it a lot as a kid or something, but like they fall down and your immediate instinct is, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. You're okay, get back up, you're okay. Even in like happy mom voice, it still is like telling them, like, you, that didn't hurt. And they're like, but it did hurt. I just fell. So be careful of that one would be like a way of trying to correct. Or like in the grocery store, they want a treat and you're saying no and they get upset, and it would be very easy for the first thing you say to be like, you're fine, stop. Like, no, do not cry about this. And that is in fact an authentic emotion. They are disappointed that they don't get a treat. They like treats. And you saying no is disappointing. And then discipline, of course, we'll get there. Discipline, of course, being like they have an emotional response to something that is truly angering, hurtful, frustrating, disappointing, sad, and you give them a consequence for that emotional expression that could just be really confusing. That's a different thing. We'll get there. So I know y'all have like, you're brimming over with questions. Wait, and just if I don't get there, we'll ask questions in the end. All right, so number two is where we're going to spend a good bit of time. This is help them identify distinct emotions by identifying emotion words just like you would like vehicles on the road. What do you do with your little boys all day long? Truck, car, ambulance, fire truck, monkey, giraffe, zebra, blue, red, green. All day long, we're giving them language, right, and helping them understand their world. So we're going to do that with emotion words, feeling words. And what that looks like is just picking key words for each category of emotion. I keep forgetting that this is up here and people are like walking by and like, sorry, that didn't need to be up there that whole time. So I have there a list of words that we use a lot, all the time, on repeat in our house. And you could decide to sub in something different, a different synonym for one of those words. But these are the ones that we use a lot. And what we're going to do is we're going to brainstorm with your partner opportunities that come up in your day where you can very clearly say, I know what that emotion is, and you define it for them. So an example would be, you want that treat, and I said no, that is disappointing. Grandma has been here for a few days, but now she has to leave. That is sad. You built that puzzle all by yourself. I am so proud of you. You built that puzzle and your sister broke that puzzle. You are frustrated and you are angry. You feel angry. Those would be some examples. So go through that list with your partner and try and think that way. What are the opportunities in my day where I can be naming emotion for them? We're having to hurry just a little bit, but I think it would be great for you guys to go back to that and think of through your day, all the ways you can identify these words. Somebody give me one example you came up with for where a negative emotion might arise that you identified. Yep. I thought scary was on the list. It must have gotten edited out. We use scary a lot. Fear. Yeah, that's a great one. And like what I think of your example of bringing him to bed with you, wouldn't that be doing something similar to what my mom would do with the ice cream, where it's like, all right, let's just fix it in the moment. So I don't know that that's necessarily better. And like to your point, if you start creating that habit, where does it stop? I think those are great questions. And we're all going to have those things. And thankfully, we have each other. That y'all talk more about that offline. Let me just get my head back in my notes here. This is something that I wanted us to have time to practice with our partner, but we don't have time for that. So I'm going to keep moving And I'm sorry that we're missing that opportunity. But the nice thing is, every time you start doing it with your kids, is practice. So, you know, start identifying their emotions when you have the opportunity. And number three, and this I think is necessary for all kids, but can be especially helpful for those of you who only have little nonverbal kids right now, is you comfort them with your presence. And this communicates to them value, and that this moment for you matters to me. And I think this is subtly where my mom missed it, is instead of just sitting with me in my sadness, she wanted to fix it. She wanted to pull me out of it by giving me ice cream, something to be excited about. And that's a subtle difference, but a lot of my day is just somebody's upset about something and I stop what I'm doing and I just get on their level and I just sit. And sometimes they want to hug and sometimes they don't, but they almost always seem to be comforted by just having me there and communicating this moment for you matters. And I'm not going to stop your tears. I'm just going to sit here with you and affirm that this is sad or hard or scary. So troubleshooting, and this is where like all the questions fall, because 1, 2, and 3 are super simple in many ways. And the great thing is, y'all, those will go so far, but you do run into things that don't fit under those one neat little 1, 2, 3. So the first is when they're having an emotion and you're not sure where it's coming from. It's not so simple as I fell down and I'm hurt. And we had a big experience of this back in the fall with Sadie. She came out dressed for school, and I told her to change clothes. For one reason or another, I thought she needed to be in something else. And I didn't do it in a mean way or a harsh way, but it was like pretty quick, like, oh, you know, you don't wear that, go wear this. And I hear her crying, and then she starts walking towards me, and she's not crying anymore. Now she's holding her chest. And like, so I think what happened in that moment is she was having anxiety of some kind to some degree. And in that moment, I knew it had been brought on by that interaction, most likely. I didn't really know what about that interaction, though, was making her anxious. So in the moment, I helped her through it. We breathed. I just sat with her. We didn't do anything. Tried to help her calm down. And then we finished getting ready for school and we went on with our morning. But then I knew later we're going to come back to this. And I think I needed that space. And thankfully she's old enough now that they don't just walk away from something and forget it, right? Like when they're 2, you got to deal with something right then, because later they're not going to remember it. But for Sadie, I have time to reflect back. So what I needed to do was ask questions. And the time I had that morning while she was at school was helpful for me to even think about what are those questions that I need to ask her. And the key thing here is, how can I make them simple, the questions, simple and clear and short in their phrasing? Simple and short, no big words, no obtuse or abstract ideas, and avoid open-ended questions. And this is a little different with adults. You want open-ended questions when it comes to people's feelings, because you don't want to put them in a box with your idea of how they should feel. But with kids, open-ended questions are largely unhelpful, because they're just like, I'm good, that's fine. You know, like they don't. So you can give, instead of an open-ended question, you can give options. Did you feel this or this or not those things? So you're giving the option that you could be wrong in what you're identifying, but you're still giving them concrete options. And we went through a few of those where she was like, no, not that, not either of those, before we got to one that seemed to really land with her. So those are my tips for asking questions. And coming at it from a place of humility, I knew it was probably me who caused it. And I knew in the end, what I'm doing here is I am repenting and I am apologizing to her. But I need to know, I want to know for what. And I want to be clear on that. And so that is how we went forward. Now, the difference between expressing emotion and manipulation. Now, we do teach our kids that word. We have defined the word manipulating. And I know y'all are like, okay, 18 months, seriously? No, not at 18 months, but it will come. And they need to know it. And they can learn these words sooner than you realize, y'all. They still shock me sometimes when they like throw out a four-syllable word. I'm like, where did you even hear that? Often they use it wrong, but. Okay, manipulating is using your words or actions to get what you want. Which means sometimes crying is manipulation. We call that whining. Using your words or actions to get what you want, because it's not the expression of an authentic emotion, it's using the action of crying to try and change something or get what you want. That's manipulation, that's whining. Now, Kelsey's favorite, what about the drama? So, this, and we use the word drama and dramatic, and we define those words for them. So, being dramatic is when you're making something seem worse or more badder than it is. And what is drama? It's a vying for attention, right? And so I think the balm for drama is when you validate emotion, sit with them in their emotion, and don't try to change their circumstances to fix their emotions. It should free them from drama eventually, being the key word. This is not something they're going to learn quickly. They will learn it quickly if you spank for them being dramatic. And that is a line that you have to toe really carefully. And the choice we've made in our house is to err on the side of caution, because it is more important to me that they know that their feelings are safe here than it is to get the behavior I want more quickly. So I'm going to have to deal with more meltdowns and more drama over time. But in the end, my hope would be that they learn that eventually, that they don't need to be dramatic, and we didn't risk them not feeling safe with their emotions. So I'm going to say that again. If you validate emotion, sit with them in their emotion, and don't try to change their circumstances or fix the emotion, it should free them from drama. Because you're giving them of your attention, and they eventually will learn to trust that when they're upset, you're there. Because over time, you've shown them, I am here for you when you're upset. So they don't need to be dramatic. And then the kind of dramatic that's being used, like what a tantrum is, to get what they want. If you never, ever, never change course in the face of drama, your decision, then eventually, right, that won't become a learned behavior, because it doesn't work to change their circumstances. So that would be my other tip. You don't ever, especially, like, there are times when I'll say, like, no, we're not going to watch a show right now. But then I'm thinking in the back of my head, like, oh, I guess maybe we could. And, like, somebody falls to the floor and cries. I'm like, oh, nope, guess we're not. Because never can they think that doing that got me to change my mind. Yeah, and they're going to embarrass you sometimes, and you're going to feel totally out of control, and that's definitely going to happen. And I do just err on the side of, like, sitting with them until it calms down. And if you have a child who takes, like, who just really seems to have an endless amount of those screams in them, then we do, if it's affecting everybody else, then we'll send them to their room to have those emotions. But that, you kind of have to figure that out in your own house, what works for you. My kids don't seem to have that endless fuel for just going and going and going. Eventually, they seem to calm down. But yeah, and that when they're screaming, you're really not using your words in that moment because they're not listening. You're wasting your breath. So yeah, in that situation, you're starting with number three. And then, yeah, you can ask questions later to try and understand. You can give them a word. If you know what was going on in that moment, you can help them understand later. But yeah, in that moment, it's probably just your presence. But don't change course. And then it should eventually, that's the key word, y'all, eventually. And this means that the three-nager stage might last longer than you want it to. And mostly it just might require a lot of patience and a lot of humility. And if y'all aren't there yet, the three-nager is like when they figure this stuff out and they start having just emotion on emotion on emotion. And it is somewhat like what we hear about when you're a teenager and you're hormonal. Oh, shoot. Ah, okay. Yes. So you mentioned hitting sister or brother. Discipline, y'all, it says it in Hebrews, it's painful rather than pleasant. Your good discipline of your children will cause emotions. That's not wrong. So that is not a wrong time for them to have a negative emotion. In fact, it can help you learn about your kids. I have one who gets really angry and indignant in discipline, and I have one who just gets so sad. And that is, it's a way of learning about my kids, and you still, you know, that doesn't mean you don't discipline. Hold on, I had something important to say about that. Okay, now, when they just don't feel like it is another big one. What about when their feelings are stopping them from doing something that's good or necessary? We write this down. We tell God, or did I already write it down? Tell God, remember the truth, ask for help. Steve came up with that. We repeat it all day long, so much so that now they know it. And what that means is you tell God what you're feeling, and when they're little, we do it for them. Tell God what you're feeling. I don't want to clean up because I'm still playing. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm disappointed. Whatever it is, I remember the truth that God loves me. God gave me a mom and dad to take care of me and do what's good for me. And I can trust them and obey right now and ask for help. God, help me obey even though I don't want to. God, help me trust my parents, even though I don't right now. Yeah. So, and I could send out more like actual written notes, but obedience and emotion can and should go hand in hand, just as it does with our walk with God. 1 Peter 4:19, therefore let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful creator while doing good. So, we validate feelings all day long, but it doesn't mean you don't have to do what's good and right and necessary. God is in that moment with you. And then, yes, with your husband, there's a great talk from Jennifer about parenting with your husband when they're not always on the same page. This is a tough topic in that a lot of our husbands are even less emotionally developed than we are. And so my big tips from Steve are pray for him, pray in general, and express your own emotions. When the opportunity comes to express in articulate ways, in non-threatening ways, non-accusing ways, how you're feeling, how you're experiencing something, it can start to give him a language for that stuff. Steve would say he's learned a lot about his feelings by how I communicate. And I often feel things for him that he doesn't feel. Like, we should be pissed at your mom right now. I don't know if you know that, but we should. So, sorry. I really, we should have started closer to on time, but... God help us.